Thank you, Nils. I'm always very much aware that no one is ever any better than their last show. And Nils, thank you very much for the introduction, very kind and totally undeserved. And thank you, all, Robert in particular, for the invitation. Robert has actually finally managed to forgive me for giving him his first introduction to the profession in Manchester for a one-year temporary contract, and he made the awful decision not to get out then, and look what he's got, where it's got him. So, thanks, Rob. Okay, now, I'm not sure how close I am to the microphone, and because I'm hard of hearing myself these days, I'm very much aware of people not hearing, but am I okay at the moment? It's okay. If not, then sort of stand up and wave your hands about and so forth, because this is actually a difficult room from the acoustic point of view. Now, Mark Twain. Mark Twain, of course, wrote things like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, but actually some very funny travelogues, including one called A Tramp Abroad, which is as an appendix has got a little piece called The Awful German Language, and appeared in 1880. Excuse me, it's an account of a trip through Germany. It's very much worth reading because he spent his time in Heidelberg in the days of student dueling and so forth, and, you know, the cynical American coming in and watching all the Germans being very, very silly. It is very much worth reading. But the thing is that he went there to learn German, and he devoted upward of 9 full weeks to trying to learn the German language. And in this appendix, The Awful German Language, he discusses some of what he sees as its failings. Before he makes 8 suggestions for improving it, because, like abolishing the dative case, because, as you see, it confuses the plurals. Besides, nobody knows you're in the dative case except you discover it by accident, then you don't know how you got into it, how long you've been in it, or how you're ever going to get out of it. In short, as he says, a gifted person ought to learn.
Sorry, we went the wrong room.
Okay. I'll just leave you watching that. As you say, a gifted person ought to learn English, barring spelling and pronouncing, in 30 hours, French in 30 days, German in 30 years. And it basically, the problem with German is it needs trimming down and repairing, because if it's to remain as it is, it ought to be gently and reverently set aside among the dead languages, because only the dead have got time to learn. Now, all good knockabout stuff. Those of us try to make a living teaching German to native speakers of English, it's a serious problem. There's a persistent view among the British that German is impossibly difficult, and Germans themselves are convinced that Deutsche Sprache schwere Sprache. Conference I went to a few years ago, speaker after speaker complained how German was disadvantaged as a foreign language because it was clearly so much more difficult to learn for other Europeans than English. Actually, Germans can be their language's worst enemies. The thing is that they're actually quite proud of the idea that a famous American writer came in and found their language impossibly difficult. It's something that you go onto the web and there you can download the original in German, and I think there are more German versions of it up there to download than there are English versions. The Germans really like this idea that their language is awful. Now, what I want to do tonight is to show you, and following what Neil says, that you're actually wrong, Twain was actually wrong, that you made the right decision, and there's nothing more difficult about German than any other language. Now, much of the difficulty of German, as Twain says, is that it seems to be focuses on the supposed complexity of its rules and inflections, as Mark Twain said. Mark Twain mentions other familiar supposed difficulties like the problem of putting a load of verbs at the end. Your sentences have to be finished by shoveling in things like Haben Sie gewesen. Sorry, Haben Sie gewesen gehabt, haben Sie geworden sein. At the end. Words to that effect, just to round things off. And of course, there's also the problem of long words. The spoof article in his diary that in the hospital yesterday a word of 13 syllables was successfully removed from a patient, unfortunately from the wrong place with fatal consequences. But of course, a lot of the problem he has with German is the endings. And inflection. For instance, he gives a list of the adjective endings. This isn't his list, this is my list. What I forgot to do was to bring the plug copy of my book, but this is taken from it. Mark Twain suggests that anyone who tries to memorise them is going to be a candidate for the asylum. He goes on, the thing is that you have all these adjectives and you've got to decline them, and of course there are more adjectives, as he says, in the language than there are black cats in Switzerland, and they must all be as elaborately declined as the examples above. Difficult, troublesome. Heard a Californian student in Heidelberg say in one of his calmest moods that he'd rather decline two drinks than go on to an adjective. Now, much of the supposed difficulty with the inflections comes down to the gender of nouns. Now, Mark Twain has a view, again, on the gender of nouns. A young lady has no sex, while a turnip has. Now, of course, you've got to know the German words for these to sort out what he's talking about. Tree is male, buds female, leaves new to horses are sexless, dogs are male, cats are female. Tomcats included, of course. Actually, this isn't true, but obviously, unlike the Californian student a minute ago, Mark Twain had never actually experienced the Carter, which is possible. But it means that things can be referred to as he, she, or it, or women as it, and so forth. Now, to illustrate this nonsense, he tells a funny story. You can have a look at this. I'm afraid it's not too good on the screen. You can probably work it out. The story of the fishwife, das Fischwife, and its sein trauriger Schicksal. And it goes on. It's too long to relate here, but you can work it out as you go down. Just to explain how unspeakably counterintuitive German gender is. Now, the thing is, gender isn't unique to German. Most other European languages have two or three genders, so you've got to assume they've got some kind of basis in cognitive principles, although some eminent linguists have wondered what they're for. I think one of the things that, as English learners of German, we need to ask ourselves is actually precisely what's it for? I was always amazed how few students had actually asked themselves that question. But basically, there's no necessary link between gender, men, women, and things, natural gender, and grammatical gender. Gender's just a system for classifying nouns that surfaces in patterns of agreement with adjectives and pronouns, and in some languages, verbs. Just thank yourself lucky you're not learning Arabic. But that gives us a clue to the main function, because in practice, gender provides kind of signals in the sentence to show what words belong with what other words. If you've ever coped with Latin verse, you'll know about that. But a German sentence like "Willst du sie kaufen?" is different from "Willst du ihn kaufen?" You can identify it more quickly than you can for English. It can make it clearer what you want to buy than it. And it's noteworthy that a lot of groups of semantically related words in German are actually different gender. One of the ways I remember learning the gender of the knife, fork, and spoon in German was remembering that there was one of each. It's the same with Mund, Wange, Kinn. Okay, one of each. And surprising just how many of them there are. And of course, gender helps us pick your way around phrases like that. Because you might not think it's necessarily a good thing to have constructions like that in the language, but it means you can do it. Okay. Now, a lot of languages have noun classification systems, not always called gender. Most complex are in Africa. Bantu languages, most sub-Saharan African languages, habiting 10 and 20 genders. Swahili's got 16. The original Bantu language probably had something like 22. But the question is how they're learnt and how nouns get their gender. In some languages, like Russian, it's relatively straightforward because you can tell what gender a Russian noun is because of its shape. Basically, words that end in a consonant are masculine, words that end in A are feminine, words that end in O and E are neuter. Most of the Slavonic languages work like that. It's fairly straightforward. Other languages, like the Bantu language, it's the meaning that decides what gender it is, but often with exceptions. So let's just look at another example, a much more exotic. Dirbal is the general linguist example for everything. It's a language spoken by about 20 people in northeast Queensland and has every possible difficulty you could possibly think of. Here, basically you've got four genders and you could generalise them as masculine, feminine, fruit and veg and meat. But, you know, some of them, you know, it's a bit far-fetched, some of them. I'm not sure about meat at the end there with grass and mud and stones. But, okay, you know, may get a bit problematic out in the desert occasionally. Okay, the problem with German, and actually with French as well, is that there doesn't seem to be a phonetic or a semantic rationale. There's a lot of evidence that what German children actually do is learn genders like I was taught to. In other words, you take it with the article. And that German children actually avoid using nouns with an article or with another word until they're fairly sure what the gender is. There can be five or six before they actually do that. Certainly, as far as peer studies of acquisition have been fairly clear that is actually what happens. There are some semantic rules, you know, winds are masculine, trees are feminine, but a very small proportion of meaning rules. Some partially phonetic ones, words in E are feminine. That's 95% of words in E are feminine, which is actually quite handy because it means that the ones you've got to learn are the exceptions, like das Ende. That's actually not bad. But the crucial thing is something like 75 or 80% of words in German is absolutely automatic because of the endings of complex words. If you take the vocabulary as a whole, you've got something like 75-80% covered by that set of rules. That leaves about 1,500 monosyllables, which you really do have to learn. And they're not that difficult. One of the ways I cracked it, I remember, was that someone told me that most nouns that come from verbs by changing a vowel, like Bruch or Schlag, or you don't need to change the vowel, you keep it like Schlag, they're all masculine. And it's amazing how many common words that covers and how useful that one is. Certainly, it's the most useful rule I remember ever being told about how to cope with gender in German. of course, this gives you the notorious neuter girl, you know, Mädchen and Fräulein and so forth. Even with those monosyllables, it's again worth knowing that something like 60% of them are masculine, 25% feminine, 15% neuter. Problem for English speakers is if you don't know a gender, you tend to guess neuter. In fact, if you guess masculine, you've got something like a 3-4-1 better chance of getting it right. Another notorious bugbear of German is noun plurals. Mark Twain doesn't say much about it, one of very well-known, famous modern linguists, Stephen Pinker, has talked about it. He's known through his book, The Language Instinct. And in chapter 8 of his book, Words and Rules, it's actually entitled The Horrors of the German Language. He refers to Mark Twain and says a person who hasn't studied German can form no idea of what a perplexing language it is. This is quoting Mark Twain. Let the pupil make careful note of the following exceptions. He runs his eye down and finds that there are actually more exceptions than words that follow the rule. What Pinker says is, of put that by our language so perverse, so sadistic. You've guessed it, of course, it's German. German has eight ways of forming the plural of nouns, and German textbook authors have made heroic efforts, and one linguist eked out 10 rules, but tacked on 17 lists of exceptions. Now, in fact, it's not that bad. That's my attempt at putting some order on German plurals. Stephen Pinker actually draws one or two conclusions from that. First, that the German plural ending S is actually the regular plural of German. Now, that does seem to give a whole new sense to the notion of regularity. It covers about 1% of the nouns of German. what Pinker says is that it's actually a Notplural. If German doesn't know the gender of a word, they'll put S on it. Not actually, strictly speaking, the case. I mean, Pinker is a psycholinguist, and he did some tests with native speakers and found enough of them did that to satisfy him, but there's quite a lot of cases where they won't. what Stephen Pinker says is this is exactly what happened in English, that in English, in the history of English, the plural S, which was used for a small number, actually many more than 1%, was actually then generalised to all the rest of the nouns. Nothing similar has happened in German, and despite what Pinker predicts, it probably won't. Each noun still has its own plural, but there are actually more regularities than he admits. You can actually again cover something like 3/4 of German noun plurals with 4 rules. Quite straightforward. The American linguist Leonard Bloomfield put that up in his book Language in 1930, and it works more often than people are taught. I'll come back to that later, actually. But even so, there's nothing odd about irregularities in language, and every language has regular and irregular forms. The only language that doesn't is artificial language like Esperanto. In practice, noun plurals are particularly prone to irregularity. A lot of languages seem to treat noun plurals almost as separate words. And anyone who's ever tried to learn Russian knows about the sheer horror of the genitive plural. Stephen Pinker tells the story of a Russian, by a Russian humorist, Mikhail Zaschenko, about a night watchman, a relatively uneducated Russian, who couldn't order a set of pokers because, like most Russians, he didn't know what the genitive plural was. That includes the other problem that with numerals in Russian you have to use the genitive plural, except for some numerals you use the genitive singular. That's just totally by the by. Closer to home, you only need to go 20 miles or so west of here to find out a language where forming the plural of nouns is, shall we say, significantly more complicated than it is in German. The et cetera is with feeling. Have you ever tried to learn Welsh? Okay, so we might want to take issue with Pinker in overemphasising the horrors of the German language, but the other conclusion is a clear one. All languages have grammar. Most languages actually have quite a lot of grammar. And what Pinker, as a psycholinguist, says in his important conclusion is that all languages reflect the workings of the brain in some way, and that ultimately gives the lie to Mark Twain. No language has a monopoly of complexities. What strikes English language learners is that other languages, particularly German, appear to be daunting or awful because they've got a lot of morphology, a lot of endings to learn, a lot of changing the forms of words where English doesn't, grammatical categories like gender and case and so forth. I've never not mentioned case. Mark Twain says something nasty about the dative, but English learners tend to think German is difficult because you've got 4 cases to learn. You should be so lucky. depending on how you count, so a language like Finnish has got 13 or 14 or 15, you really do need to pick them up. And there are all sorts of irregularities involved. So, of course, the thing is, Finnish doesn't have genders, it doesn't have articles, you know, it swings and roundabouts in many ways. English has lost a lot of its endings. It's not gone as far as Chinese, where, you know, the forms of words just don't alter. But it doesn't mean that English, as many English people and a lot of other Europeans seem to think, is very straightforward to learn, because it doesn't have a lot of grammar. Endings aren't all there are to a language. And English also has quite a lot of problems for foreigners who try to learn it, and probably one or two one or two non-native speakers here who've got a problem. What the problem of English tends to involve is questions of syntax, sentence construction and so forth. And here very often you find grammatical structures which are very difficult to state in terms of rules. Simple thing to start with, articles. Just try to imagine what it's like if your native language, like Finnish, which you just mentioned, or one of the Slavonic languages, doesn't have a definite or indefinite article. How are you going to learn to make the difference between I ate a banana and I ate the banana, or I married a man and I married the man, or did you marry the man, or did you marry a man? You know, you've got to sort that out. Can be quite critical. The rules are much more difficult to set out and follow than rules for which ending you put on a particular case. A lot of the familiar European languages have articles too, but they're not always used the same way, and differences between English and German can be quite a problem. German can use the definite article often quite different ways to English. For instance, similar, die Butter kostet 3 Euro das Pfund. We wouldn't use the article for the butter. German tends to use general articles with generalizations like that. And one of the things you find in translation theory, if you ever try to translate between the languages, what you find is that German tends to use articles like that with a singular. What's the natural equivalent for that sentence in English? It took me a long, long time to work this out. But the actual way is that English tends to use plurals where German uses an article with a noun. It's amazing how often that happens, and what a difference that makes to, you know, being idiomatic in German, actually cracking that one. So the other thing about English is that we can join verbs together in a number of ways, sometimes with an infinitive and sometimes with the ing form, the participle or gerund. He likes talking, he likes to talk. Some verbs you can use either with. Sometimes you can use either, but with a different meaning. He tried speaking French to her. He tried to speak French to her. With remember, we use one with the present tense. I remember walking over London Bridge. Another with the future. I'll remember to walk over London Bridge. Not easy. The big Cambridge English Grammar of Huddleston and Pullum, that's 1,840 pages of English grammar. Pretty good for a language that doesn't have any grammar. that has 20 pages in it. Michael Swan's Practical English Usage, which is one of the best guides I know to English for foreign learners, and one I always used to recommend to students going abroad to teach English for the year in schools in Germany or Austria. He has 6 pages on it, tries to bring some kind of order to it, sets of rules and sub-rules. He then ends up with saying, well, basically, if you don't know, you're going to have to look at the Oxford Advanced Learners Dictionary of Current English. So, you know, and Quirk, Greenbaum, Leach, Schwartwick, Grammar of Contemporary English, and other of the big grammars, just give long lists of verbs like that, which you all have to learn off separately. And note the vicious etceteras in there at various points. You know. note that there are as many exceptions to the rules as the rule itself. Bitchum. Okay. One of the problems Mark Twain faced, though, certainly, he went over to Germany to learn German in 9 weeks, was certainly how it was taught. Clear it from looking at the bit that he was being taught German by what is known now as the grammar translation method. What you did was, grammar was seen as a relatively abstract process, You're given a set of rules, you memorize the rules, tables of endings to learn, you practice them through translating. And the basis of the method is you teach these rules and then you're expected to apply them. Actually, I just missed one of the notorious difficulties of English, because you all know what that spells.
Fish,
thank you. F as in laugh, I as in women, sh as in revolution. Simple, fish. That's George Bernard Shaw's example. Okay, now, rules. You want to say the German sentence, when we'd come with our friends, fairly straightforward kind of clause. And what you do, you have to learn the rules off, and apart from the words, and you put them in. You've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. More or less there. Once you've gone through all those rules which you've learnt separately and chanted them off to the teacher's satisfaction, you can then put the sentence together. Dead easy. Of course, conversation might have gone on a bit in the meantime, but it's obviously not an awfully good model for producing a sentence when you're actually trying to say something to a German. So the thing was that in those days, and I must admit I learnt German like this, Neil said I was going to do some biography, most of it concerns how badly I was taught German. The thing was that with rules like that, the German master I had in third and fourth form coming up to A level, his very simple method of making sure that we knew the rules involved a large slipper. And these days they just lock him up, but 50 years ago he could get away with it. And so hence my interest in German grammar, I felt it very very keenly at the time. But the thing was that it was all based on the model of learning a dead language like Latin. The what you were aiming for was absolute formal correctness in writing, not communicating. It was also expected that each stage, each rule or set of rules could be mastered or applied without error before you go on to the next one. So once you've been told that nouns in German add N in the dative plural, unless the plural ends in N or S, it's number 8 there. Once you've learnt number 8, you're then expected to apply that rule automatically without error, and any failure to do so would naturally be a sign of idleness or stupidity, hence my German teacher's slipper. What you're supposing is that you learn you can acquire as each stage the competence of an educated adult native speaker who themselves received extensive formal instruction in their own language. And so, now, this method did enable a few fortunate pupils to acquire a high level of competence in the foreign language. Shortcomings are easy to identify. And when I first joined the department in Manchester, all our students were being taught like this. And I remember saying to the then professor at the end of my first year that actually we didn't need any language exams. All we needed was the Cologne Station test. We would give each of our students a 100-mark note, very generous actually in those days, give each of our students send them up in a plane with a parachute, push them out over Cologne Station, and the ones that managed to get back home made it. And we reckon, actually, in terms of communicative competence, small proportion of the students would actually make it back, because they wouldn't have been able to buy a train ticket. So you're concentrating on the limited register of formal writing, and it relies on the very dubious assumption that learners can consciously convert rules into processes that are known subconsciously. One of the persistent complaints of German teachers is that you can tell students 100 times that the dative plural ends in N, and they still don't do it. But it's precisely because you can't convert explicit knowledge into automatic production in this way. So One of the consequences has been a shift in recent years to communicative competence, so that pupils learn the language rather than learn about the language. Now, there are ways in which this has been equally disastrous in terms of actually teaching British people to learn foreign languages. Because, not always explicitly, people assume that it involves learning the foreign language like you learnt your first language. The romantic idea, which little support, that that you can sort of be somewhere near the foreign language and you just pick it up as you go along. That's actually very difficult after what's called the critical period, after the age of about 8. People cannot learn languages in that way anymore, in quite the same way. But the problem is that the idea that what you're looking for is communicative competence means that it fosters myths about language learning. You know, the magic wand myth. Somehow or other you can wave the magic wand and you're going to come away speaking the language. Now, the adverts of newspapers are full of things, you know, learn a language in 20 hours without any grammar. I don't know why. I mean, you must obviously be able to make a lot of money in that way, but I'm not quite... You know, there's a secret I've missed somewhere in there. But anyway, the idea that is, of course, you know, that you can... all you need to do is to learn a foreign language, sit back and let the sounds waft over you without any active participation. Well, apart from anything else, it's been estimated it takes a native speaker child something like 5,000 hours of intensive one-to-one contact with a sympathetic instructor or instructors, i.e. mummy, to gain fluency. This is one of the problems in primary school language, the notion of primary school language teaching. A lot of people think that, you know, if you put languages into primary school, then British people are going to learn them more quickly. It's not, because you're not in the environment where that language is being used. And a couple of hours a week in a primary school, people aren't going to learn any faster. It's 5,000 hours? Well, I mean, you could probably get anyone up to fluency in 5,000 hours of intensive one-to-one tuition, but that's not going to be available in any educational framework. I reckon that 40 quid an hour... You charge 40 quid an hour for intensive one-to-one tuition. Yeah. That brings it up to something like 200,000 to get fluency. Okay. Now, I mean, we've actually been trying to get this back off our kids, but they're not very sympathetic on that one. Okay. Now, there are obviously limitations as to what you can achieve this way. Concentration on communicative competence can be quite limiting. Danger is that it can be restricted in practice to learning a few ready-to-use expressions for functions provided by the syllabus without any attention paid to developing the learner's command of the language as a system, so that you're not put in the position of being able to use the language independently to make your own sentences up, basically. You're learning how to say a few things, but you're not learning the grammar. And one of the problems with abandoning the old grammar translation method has been the failings has led to discarding any reference to grammar at all in foreign language teaching. Grammar seemed to be the problem. People wanted to learn languages, you know, I want to learn the language, but I don't want to learn the grammar. And so there was a time when it almost became taboo to mention grammar in foreign language teaching. So what happened was that people could communicate in a number of situations, but be at a loss outside these. In fact, people have been reassessing the role of grammar in foreign language teaching in recent years, and recognising that explicit grammatical knowledge can help learners break out from fossilisation, just being able to use a few sentences. Ultimately, it's nonsense to regard communication and grammar as some way as alternatives. You can't communicate except at a very primitive level without some idea of the forms of the input and creating your own sentences on the basis of grammatical structures. But you've got to be clear what we mean about grammar. It's not the memorising rules and tables divorced from any content or any kind of communication, but assimilating the basic structure of the language. What's happened in more recent years, is that people need to be aware what's involved with the language, that you need insight into the pattern of the language, curiosity about contrasting patterns of your first language and the foreign language is actually valuable. You know, just using the foreign language isn't necessarily a good thing. That being able to compare the foreign language with your own language is actually something valuable. And the other thing is that different people learn languages in different ways. One of the things that's very important in learning a language is to be aware of what you're doing and how you're doing it. I find a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of students, and I found, tended not really to think about this. They tended to look at the grammar books, do the exercises and so forth, but not actually think about how they were learning and what processes they were using for learning. But cognitive processes are valuable. Just a couple of possibilities. Rather than just learning learning structure of sentences, actually looking at some sentences and finding the subject, finding what the subjects are saying. In other words, who's doing what? You know, when you look at a German sentence, you've got to ask who's doing what to whom. These are just some examples taken from German and Austrian newspapers. I'm particularly keen on the second one, which fooled me when I read it. Because I also automatically assume that this poor drunk was being attacked by the policeman. But you look at it carefully and you find it is actually the other way around. Perfectly normal sentence from an Austrian newspaper that I picked up a few years ago to read on the plane home. So it's valuable doing things like this in German because it teaches you what all those complicated endings are for. You've got to learn how to process the sentence. To do that, you've got to pick out, first of all, if you read a German sentence, you pick out who's doing what to who. Start out from there. Discovering those in texts is much more effective than learning lists of verbs and take the dative. But you then follow it up by constructing your own sentences and manipulating the ones. Discovery tasks like this are quite neat. One for noun plurals, for instance, you've got four rules for forming the plural. You just run through and get yourself a sample and see how good those rules actually are. And we'll actually show you. If you take letter L or something like all the simple nouns, it needs to be the simple nouns, obviously not compound nouns, get a sample of a couple of hundred, you'll find you're always coming out around about 75 to 80%. Doing things, discovery tasks like this are actually quite neat. In fact, the thing is that you've probably done this kind of thing subconsciously yourselves. Has anyone ever tried the Nuss test on you? No. Okay. Right. The strict rules of this one are that only undergraduates can play, and only those who are not native speakers of German. Right? No cheating. I can see who the Germans are. Okay. The Nuss test. Okay. Word Nuss. You all know what it means. It's a nut. Okay. It's quite straightforward. And a word like that could potentially have four plurals. There are some that are not possible because of shape. Okay. Who thinks the plural is Nuss? Who thinks the plural of this is Nuss? You've also all got... There's no... no abstentions on this one, okay? You know, no fence sitting. Who thinks the plural is Nusser? Right, yeah. Couple. Nussen? No takers. Nusser? Ah. Okay. Nussach with an R? He's voted twice, wait a minute. Okay. Right. Nearly every, all but one or two got it right. The plural is Nüsse. Okay. Three genders in German. Der, die, und das. Who thinks it's der Nuss?
50%-ish. Who thinks it's Dinus? Couple out the back. Who thinks it's Dasnus? There's a lot of abstentions in here. We're
sitting on the fence on this one, guys. Okay. Right.
Never fails. There's people tend to go for Dasnus, for the reason I mentioned earlier, because automatically it's a thing, so it must be neuter. Bad.
The other thing is that those people who actually had the guts to vote, the majority came out with dea. More came out with dea than dea. Now, it is in fact D. It's Dinus. Now, the reason you went for D is that you know the plural nusse has an umlaut and an E.
Now, all things being equal, most nouns that have a plural and umlaut and E are masculine. So you've got the rule right. But there are quite a few exceptions, but not as many as Mark Twain said, or Stephen Pinker. There are only about perhaps a dozen common feminine nouns that have a plural like, as if they were masculine. And those are the ones you need to know.
That's today's exercise. But it does mean that you've actually taken note of what is normal in German, what's regular in German. You know that the plural... It's also, the thing is, of course, that it's a word you tend to see more often in the plural than the... You know, even at this time of year. Möchten Sie Nüsse? You know, no one... if you say, you know, Möchten Sie eine Nuss? Okay.
You know, techniques like this, you know, you develop and understand the structure of the language, and you can overcome blocks and difficulties in German by exploiting and developing analytical skills, just by spotting things that are a bit unusual, things you hadn't expected. And that's that basically is the way to do it, more than anything, by reading and listening, which are the passive skills that come first. The active, you can't have any active skills until you've got the passive skills. You know, speaking, people talk about, can you speak a language? That's the thing in a way that's most difficult. But it is the one that you need to have that knowledge of the language. You need to hear and see the language before you can actually turn it into yourself. So learning any language. And what's not helpful is what Mark Twain found out. Grammar seemed, you know, just an autonomous system to be mastered for its own right without any idea of actually using it. Learning all those adjective endings off. You may as well go and take the two beers. Okay, so learning any language involves learning the grammar in some way, and languages can have a lot of grammar, and a lot of languages, as we've seen, have a lot more grammar and a lot more grammar of German that's more different to English. No language is inherently simpler than any other. The idea that, you know, languages out in Aboriginal societies might be more simple. A language like Djirbal in northeast Queensland is one of the most complex languages known. It's difficult to measure in any systematic way how different and difficult a particular language is from English. Sheer number of variables. Carl James did tried this out in 1979. His table is in David Crispell's Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language. I put it up on the board there. On the board, that dates me, doesn't it? I use PowerPoint now, I'm modern. You can probably put the calculations in. He looked at five areas: pronunciation, spelling, grammar, orthography, the alphabet, and vocabulary, and just informally guessed the distance between five of the commonly taught languages and English. Italian and Spanish seem to present fewest difficulties, followed by German, then French, then Russian. Interesting. Italian has six, if you count them up, Spanish seven, German 10, French 12, Russian 15. German has 2 points on the scale because he was allowing for the possibility that people were using the old alphabet in German. Very few Germans can read that anymore, the Faktur, the old Gothic alphabet. Anyway, if you do that, then French is actually more difficult than German. That goes against the ingrained English prejudice that French is easier than German. But when I examined in Ireland a few years ago, I was struck by the fact that Irish students, equally whose first language is English, were clear that French was actually much more difficult to learn than German. There's perceptions in there. And these kind of assessments are ultimately subjective and coloured by other attitudes and prejudices. So, I mean, learning any language is a challenge, and it's hard work, and it's frustrating and perplexing. You often find you going one step forward and two steps back. It's very difficult. One of the most difficult things is actually to monitor your own progress. I mean, a number of students who came up to me after the first semester or term and said, you know, I've been here a term and I haven't, my German's not got any better. I said, how do you know? I mean, how are you measuring it? What are you measuring it? It's actually very, very difficult. And it's very easy to get to get disheartened because you don't think you're getting any further. It's not easy to measure. It's frustrating and perplexing. It's immensely satisfying to get there and to be able to use it in the country, even to the extent as Mark Twain was quite satisfied after 9 weeks that what he was able to say was zwei Glas Bier bitte. It's the only way. Learning the language is the only way to find out anything beyond the superficial about other peoples and cultures. And paper I quoted, or I mentioned it earlier, by German professor Lutz Götze, said, die Fähigkeit, seine eigenen Gedanken in einer oder mehreren fremden Sprachen auszudrücken, ist eine Gabe und ein Wettbewerbsvorteil. Particularly, as we all know, ein Wettbewerbsvorteil, because foreign language skills are highly valued in the job market. He did actually go on to say that, but I just leave that aside. Okay, but then I actually have no hesitation in declaring that Mark Twain could be entertaining, but he's actually quite wrong. Thank you.